conservative commentators on Fox News, liberal commentators on MSNBC. To a remarkable extent, they're all advancing political positions more than 200 years old. With us today, the author of The Great Debate, Yuval Levin. From the offices of the Wall Street Journal in Washington, D.C., Uncommon Knowledge now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. Yuval Levin is the Hertog Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and the editor of National Affairs. He holds a BA from American University and a doctorate from the University of Chicago. And in the White House of President George W. Bush, he served on the domestic policy staff. Dr. Levin is the author of The Great Debate, Edmund Burke, Thomas Paine, and the Birth of Right and Left. Yuval Levin, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
The Great Debate, quote, the late 18th century was the scene of a great Anglo-American debate about the meaning of modern liberalism, close quote. What was going on in the late 18th century?
Well, of course, a lot was going on in the late 18th century. The striking thing about it is just how much was going on. It's a period that we think of as defined by the French Revolution, by the American Revolution. It was also defined, as I argue in the book, by this enormous debate about just what it was that liberal politics meant and was about.
Liberal, you're using liberal in a term in a way in which it isn't ordinarily used today.
Right.
Is that right? Go ahead and
define it. Yeah, the politics of free societies, the politics of the Anglo-American world. So liberal here really means a society that's fundamentally open, that's democratic to some extent, that believes in the rule of law, that protects the rights of the individual.
Liberal in the sense of based on liberty.
Classical liberal, yeah, exactly, based on liberty. And the interesting thing about the politics of those kinds of societies is that they often are not fundamental. That you don't find a politics where the debate is between communism and fascism or between radical views of how society should be, which you actually find very often in that period and even today in other kinds of societies, and certainly in European politics in the 19th and 20th centuries. Anglo-American politics have always been fought to some extent between the 40-yard lines. They've been debates about what our society really is, what's the best of it, where's it going, what can it make of itself. And what you find in the period of the French Revolution and the American Revolution is an argument about whether the purpose of that kind of society is to move forward toward an ideal of equality and liberty, or whether that kind of society is an achievement of many generations of gradual evolution of political ideas that had achieved an extraordinary balance of equality and liberty.
Your two principal figures, Edmund Burke and Thomas Paine. Who was Edmund Burke? And before we get to his intellectual, his positions, just give us a word on where he grew up, what he accomplished, why he's important.
Edmund Burke was an English statesman born in Ireland in 1730. He was not born to a noble family. He is not a person who, in his youth, you would have imagined would become a prominent figure in British politics. He became a prominent figure by being an extraordinary advocate for a certain kind of point of view, for a conservative Whig position, which argued that the United Kingdom was an extraordinary achievement that should be treasured, that should be refined, rather than, as a lot of Whigs were arguing and as a lot of people were arguing in the era, that the politics of the politics of the Enlightenment period were going to be about transformation. They were going to be about starting anew based on principles that were only being discovered. And they were going to be revolutionary. Burke said they're not going to be revolutionary, they're going to be evolutionary. They're going to involve gradual progress, building on the best of what we are. And in the course of a long career, Burke developed these views into something like the beginning of what we would think of as conservatism in the Anglo-American world.
You write, Yuval, in The Great Debate, Burke's upbringing and his background, quote, seemed to leave him with a lasting sense that life was more complicated in practice than in theory, and that this was a good thing.
Yeah. Burke grew up in what should have been an impossible situation. He was in Ireland in the 1730s and 40s. His father was a Protestant. His mother was a Catholic. Certainly by then, as it became so much, much more so later, Ireland was bitterly divided between Catholics and Protestants. He was educated in a Quaker school, which again cut across what you would think would be lines of dogma and division that should not have been easily crossed. And he saw communities and people living with one another in ways that, in theory, really shouldn't have worked. And they worked because there were deep wells of trust and confidence and neighborly affection and respect that people could build on. And he was left with a sense that really stayed with him his entire life, that that's what matters most in society, that at the end of the day, theories of societies are built on top of realities rather than beneath them. You don't build societies by first having the right theory and then putting it into effect. You have a society, and you try to understand it, you try to see what's best about it and build on that. And there's certainly room for theorists to explain what works and what doesn't, but they can't be put in a position where they decide what happens.
Right. Thomas Paine, your other principal figure, again, a word on his background.
Yeah. The striking thing is about both of them is that they're oddly outsiders. Given how important they became, it's really striking how far they traveled. Tom Paine was born in the south of England in 1737, so he and Burke were contemporaries. Paine is 7 years younger. He was born to a poor family, what we would think of as a poor working family. His father was a staymaker. He was involved in the business of making women's dresses. And a working man, he was never out of work, but he never had much. Paine had schooling that took him until the fifth grade, and that's it. And beyond that, was self-educated in an extraordinary way. He started his life's journey as a working-class Englishman, and you never would have thought that he would have gone much further than that. There was a great disruption in his life. His wife died in childbirth. His wife and child died. And from then on, Paine was separated from where he'd come from. He became an itinerant. He became a tax collector eventually and became very interested in politics, became very interested in philosophy, and got himself involved at one point in a dispute about how much British taxpayers were being paid. And because he was such a well-educated, self-educated person and so good at making arguments, he was basically chosen by his fellow tax collectors to make their case before Parliament. And this gave Paine a sort of taste of political combat, and it never left him. From then on, it's all he ever did. He made a case that failed, that got him, that left him bankrupt, that left him jobless, but that also brought him to a place where he just almost accidentally met Benjamin Franklin, who was then the representative of the American colonies in London. Franklin was always a talent scout and could see something in Paine. And he said to him, you know, you're at a place where you seem to be stuck. You should go to America, start over. Don't tell them you were a tax collector. Just show them what you can do. And he went to Philadelphia. Within a few months, he was the editor of the Pennsylvania Magazine and became a huge figure in the intellectual life of Philadelphia in a period that, of course, very quickly became a war for independence.
Again, the great debate. Paine's background gave him, quote, a lifelong ingrained sense that the laws of justice are clear and simple. Yeah. Burke is all complexity. Right. Paine is simplicity and clarity.
And it comes up again and again in their writings and in their debates with one another. Paine's father was a Quaker, and Paine was very deeply affected by the simple commitment to justice of the Quakers. And he always believed that at the end of the day, justice means helping the weak and not the strong, helping the weak survive the assaults from the strong. And he was always deeply moved by a desire to see that sort of justice vindicated.
So last setup before we move to their different positions, last point that we need to understand, which is the cataclysm, 1789, the French Revolution. Yeah. Both of these men write their great works defining their thinking against this event. Reflections on the Revolution in France is Burke's masterwork, mm-hmm. published 1790. Paine publishes Rights of Man 1 year later, 1791. You write that, I'm quoting you again, Thomas Paine was a self-declared and unabashed revolutionary. Burke's response to the Revolution was an intense and fiery opposition to developments in France. You better give us one paragraph on the French Revolution.
Well, so it's important to know first that the two of them found themselves more or less on the same side of the American question in the previous decade.
Right.
Paine, of course, one of the great voices for independence. He wrote Common Sense. He wrote the Crisis Papers. Was really very important in persuading Americans of the value of the movement for independence. Burke came at it from a different direction, but became persuaded very quickly that, in fact, the British government was in the wrong, that although Parliament might have the right to tax the colonists as it was doing, it was a mistake to do it. And within a fairly short period of time, he became persuaded that there was just not going to be a way to fix this and that Parliament should just let them go. He was an opponent of the war and essentially, effectively, a champion of American independence. And so Burke had had a name in America. People knew who he was because he was one of the few members of Parliament who made a case for the Americans.
You write, you note, though, that Burke never once in all his speeches and private correspondence refers to what takes place in the United, in the what would soon become the United States, as a revolution.
Well, that's right. He calls it the American War sometimes. Most of the time, he calls it a civil war, a war among Englishmen. And he never, he not only never uses the term, Burke seems never to have thought of the American Revolution as a revolution. He thought the Americans were trying to protect their rights as Englishmen, that they were being denied those rights by their own government.
They were essentially conservative.
Yeah, they wanted to preserve the way of life they'd always had, which was as quite free Englishmen abroad. And suddenly Parliament was making demands on them, was not giving them representation. And Burke came to the conclusion that these people were basically trying to protect what they had, and that the American Revolution was as he said of the English Revolution of 1688, was a revolution averted, not made. That they managed to keep what they had.
Right. Okay. So let's I mean, trying to get this book into what this is like trying to reduce an ox to a bouillon cube,
right.
But let's do our best. So let me just take you through a few of the concepts that contrast between Burke and Paine. Contrast, if you will, Yuval, Paine's natural society with Burke's historical society. Paine, give us Paine. What does he mean by natural society?
We could start this way. I would say the important thing to understand about their debate is that it was a real debate. The two of them, as you say, engaged one another, especially over the French Revolution. Burke wrote his attack on the Revolution, the reflections on the Revolution in France. The next year, Paine writes a defense of it that was explicitly a response to Burke. Burke then responds back. There's an actual back and forth. There are also personal letters between the two of them.
By the way, one thing that comes through in your book, the quotations from these men, if I may, it mattered.
Yeah, right.
These were not bright men playing intellectual games.
Right.
It mattered
That's
to both
right.
of them.
And this is, in a sense, where I'm going and answering the question about how they thought about nature and society. They got a lot of philosophical questions, and their debate was deeply philosophical in a lot of ways. But it was also very practical. It was a debate about an event that was ongoing, which they both understood themselves to be involved with. Paine, really, quite literally, he was in Paris. He knew a lot of the people at the center of the French Revolution quite well. And Burke saw the revolution as a danger, as a threat to the stability of the British system. And so they were arguing about events. They were arguing about politics. But both of them understood that at stake in that were also deep questions of philosophy, political thought, and deep questions even of anthropology, of what it was that the human being was and what society owed the individual. And so what the book tries to do is to break down their debate in these thematic ways, to understand it in its parts and then put it back together as a debate about a historical event. And when you do that, what you find is that at the bottom, both of them begin from assumptions about the relationship between nature and politics. Both assert that their way of thinking about politics is based in an understanding of nature. Paine's argument for this is maybe more familiar to us. Paine basically says that politics has to answer to natural law and to natural rights, that human beings are best understood as individuals, that society is a function of individuals joining together by choice to form a union for their common protection, for their common benefit, and that the whole purpose of that union is to serve their needs and their rights, because that's what it was formed for. Human beings, as he sees them, are always free, are always equal, and they've joined in society to make sure they can live that way. And that's what society, in the end, owes them.
That they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. That shows up right in the preamble to the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, and it comes from Locke. It works right through the kind of tradition of what becomes British radicalism. And it's very, very central to Tom Paine. It is what it's all about for him. So nature for him is a source of principles. Paine's idea of nature is like a kind of Enlightenment physics idea. It's like Newtonian. Nature gives us principles, which we can then apply to the way we live or to what we find around us. For Burke, nature gives us models of organisms. Nature is what's out there. It's what we observe. And he thought his politics was an answer to nature, too, that it begins from a sense of the human being as embedded in a social reality, as always living in a world that existed before him, and it's in some way answerable to that world. And so for Burke, human beings are always social creatures. It doesn't make much sense to think of the human person before society, because no human person's ever lived that way. And so to build your entire idea of politics on a thought experiment that could never have been real seemed to him not the best way to start to think about political principles.
The limits of reason, the great debate. Thomas Paine viewed reason as a profoundly liberating force that can help man learn his rights and establish governments equipped to guard and champion those rights. Now, you quote Paine himself. Thomas Paine wrote, "There is a morning of reason rising upon the subject of government that has not appeared before," close quote. Burke, you write, "Politics ought to be adjusted not to human reasonings but to human nature, of which," you're quoting Burke himself, "of which the reason is but a part and by no means the greatest part." Burke, you quote him again, "Our forefathers," says Burke, "acted under a strong impression of the ignorance and fallibility of mankind." So Paine has a new dawn of reason, and Burke says, "Never forget the ignorance and fallibility of mankind."
What you find here are really two views of the potential of the human person. And Paine constantly gives you the incredible optimism of the Enlightenment, of the height of the Enlightenment, where it seemed like everything was new, everything was changing. We had discovered things that were going to absolutely transform society and man. And not only in the natural sciences, but also in politics. We could find solutions to war, to poverty. It was now possible to do things that were never imaginable before. And it's all based on a notion of human perfectibility that's really essential to Enlightenment politics. Burke simply doesn't believe that everything's changed. Burke begins from a much more modest view of human possibilities. He thinks we can do great things, but only if we understand that human beings are always fallen, are always imperfect, are always subject to passions, to excesses, and have to be corrected, have to be balanced off. The excesses of human beings living together always have to be balanced off against one another. And so Burke is always looking for ways to make sure that society remains stable, whereas Paine always wants to go forward. He believes that the future that's out there waiting for us is just full of incredible possibility.
Paine and Burke on the meaning of America. Again, you quote Paine here in The Great Debate. You're quoting Paine, "The Rights of Man." "She," America, "made a stand not for herself only, but for the world, and looked beyond the advantages herself could receive," close quote. The American Revolution is the beginning of a new epoch for humankind.
This is an important strand of the thinking you find in the French Revolution, a sense that the old ways just don't have to be kept around, that there was now a chance to start over fresh. And of course, this is an important thread of the American Revolution, but it's not the only one.
I was going to say, this brings us to the last third or so, or last quarter at least, of this book. You devote to the way this great debate continues today and shows up in American thinking. So I was just so struck. Paine says, "She made a stand, America, not for herself only, but for the world." Abraham Lincoln, "America is the last best hope of earth." Ronald Reagan often said that Providence placed this country between the two oceans. George W. Bush, "We invade Iraq in part because American ideals of democracy are universal, should have universal application." The tricky bit is that we find that strain of Paine. Lincoln, Reagan, George W. Bush are essentially conservative
of
figures.
Of course, sure. And that's always...
So it's not easy. There are complexities here.
Oh, yes. No, I wouldn't by any means suggest that what you find in Burke and Paine is just today's right and left.
Right.
And in fact, the relationship between them, which I take to be more or less the first real iteration of a left-right divide, a recognizable left-right divide, the relationship between that and today's left and right, as I lay out in the book, is not genealogical, right? Today's right is not descended from Edmund Burke. It's that these two kinds of views always arise in our kind of free society because there are two ways of thinking about human beings, there are two ways of thinking about the purpose of society, and our kind of free society makes room for these two, and there are always these two. And what Burke and Paine offer you is one of the clearest and fullest and best explanations and articulations of these dispositions. And so you find in them a conservatism and a kind of radicalism. That doesn't mean that the specific views they expressed about one issue or another are going to be on the right or the left today. And of course, American conservatives have always had the challenge of conserving a political order that was born in a revolution.
Right.
That whatever Burke wants to think was born in a moment of idealism and optimism in a lot of ways. Now, the American Revolution contained different strands. The Declaration of Independence itself contains the beginning, which you quoted before, a real statement of philosophical, I think it's fair to say, radicalism, of egalitarian idealism. It also contains a statement of actual concerns and worries and
particular charges.
Yeah, and those are all about keeping what we have. Those are all about being denied by the English the way of life and the system of government that the Americans had been enjoying by then for a century and more. And so there's a conservative strand and a more radical strand right there in the beginning. And, you know, our politics has always been defined by that tension, by the pulling and pushing of those two on one another. And
so
that
also,
shape is still there.
So this brings us to the present. You pop up, if you type in reform conservatism, this is the new catchphrase. Compassionate conservatism is gone, reform
right.
conservatism. You pop it in, your name is the first thing that pops up under Google or this over and over again. So I think to myself, Yuval is a conservative.
Sure.
But on the other hand, it sounds to me as though you're saying we have this, what we have here in a liberal society such as ours, a free society, we will always have some kind of permanent Hegelian dialectic, and both are healthy, the tension is productive. You're not going to choose sides, are you?
Oh, I'm choosing sides.
You
now,
are? Okay.
To be clear, the book tries its best to be fair to both. I do finally think that Burke is much more impressive and full and rich than Paine. But it's certainly the case that both of these dispositions and ways of thinking have been part of the American experience. And one of the things that I do try to push against in the book is the notion that is prevalent in some ways on the right, that progressivism comes out of nowhere, that it comes from Germany or that it's not part of the American tradition. I think it is. There's always been a radical strand in American political thought. And in a lot of ways, it's always pushed in the kinds of directions that progressivism ended up going in, and even that Tom Paine ended up going in. By the end of his career, Paine is making a case for a kind of primordial welfare state, is making a case for a very active role for government in providing for the needs of the public. And his argument is always based on the view that the purpose of government is to liberate the individual from all constraints on him. And one of the things that helps you to see is that today's progressivism, for all of its talk of communitarianism and of we and of you didn't build that, the purpose of it really is to liberate the individual from dependence on other people. It is, in fact, based on a very radical individualism that at the end of the day wants total moral individualism and is willing to abide some economic collectivism to get there.
So let me ask you again, I'll give you a couple of quotations from the Great Debate. This is tricky. And I'd like to,
sure.
Since I have you right here, I put a question mark next to this in the book, but here's the author. The Great Debate. The fundamental utopian goal at the core of Paine's thinking, the goal of it, of liberating the individual from the constraints of the obligations imposed upon him by his time, his place, and so forth, remains essential to the left in America.
Yeah.
Got that. You just said it. But then you say the failure of the Enlightenment and its successors actually to eradicate poverty and injustice. We sit here celebrating, if that's the word, the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty. As a result of those 50 years, the poverty rate is exactly where it was 50 years ago. It didn't work. As a result of this failure, you write, the left seemed forced to choose between Paine's natural right theories and his goals.
Right.
Now explain that.
Well, so Paine makes the case and believes deeply that you can achieve these almost utopian goals of his by a commitment to natural rights, by a commitment to a theory that begins in individualism and sees the role of government as vindicating people's rights. The trouble is, the utopian goals obviously weren't achieved. And when we read Paine's language, some of the quotes he just cited, saying a new age of reason is dawn, the end of poverty, the end of war, it's impossible for us not to think that that's a little ridiculous. And it didn't happen. And so the left was faced with a choice that it fought with throughout the 19th century between a commitment to those principles and a commitment to those goals. And at the end of the day, the goals, I think, understandably, proved to be more appealing and ran deeper than the principles. And so they came to the view that these same goals could be better achieved by a much more active government, a government that took it upon itself to embody the nation in a way that Paine would, I think, not have envisioned.
So we see it in the French Revolution itself, in the embrace of Napoleon.
I think to some extent we do.
We're not getting anywhere on our own. A strong man, he's a strong man, that's not what we had in mind, but his goals are our goals.
Yeah.
Is that what's, that's
well,
what
in
you
part,
mean?
But you know, in America, we never quite went that far.
No.
And America, thankfully, has never been as radical as the French Revolution. Even our radicals were never that radical. But what you do find is progressivism moving towards a state-centered vision, a notion that the utopian goals are achievable if we understand ourselves as a whole, as a nation. You start to see it in Paine. One of the things Paine does is Paine rejects the validity, the legitimacy of everything that stands between the individual and the state. He thinks there are individuals with rights, and there's a state that exists to vindicate their rights. The people choose their leaders, and everything that's in between, be it civil society, religious institutions, civic institutions, strike him as lacking democratic legitimacy. These are power sources that are not elected. He describes them as a wilderness of turnpike gates between the individual and his rights. And he wants to clear them all out so that what you have is the state and the individual. This is still very much the underlying agenda of a lot of progressives who think seriously about these questions.
But to Burke, those turnposts are what make life worth
living.
That
is society. For Burke, society is what exists between the individual and the state. And the whole purpose of the state is to sustain a space for that society. So one of the things you find when you read a lot of Burke and Paine is all of the metaphors that Paine uses are metaphors of motion. They're all about getting there. And all of the metaphors that Burke uses are metaphors of space. They're metaphors of building and of sustaining a space in which people can live thriving lives as they understand them. And so the purpose of society is to sustain a kind of stability that allows people essentially to live out what they understand to be best.
Let me just toss out a couple of present-day issues, and you tell me how you see the great debate continuing in them now. Obamacare.
Well, so Obamacare gets at one of the great divisions between Burke and Paine, which we began to get to in talking about reason, which is basically a difference of opinion about the kind of knowledge that's available to us in society and in politics. I think of it as there being three kinds of differences between them. One is a difference of disposition. So Burke begins by being grateful for what is good about society. Paine begins by being outraged at what is bad about it. Another is a kind of anthropological difference. Burke begins, as we were saying, with a very low notion of the potential of the human person. He's very skeptical of utopianism, of the notion of perfectibility. He thinks we're trying to make the most of a very imperfect kind of creature here. Paine has a much higher view of that. But the third one, which is really critical to a lot of our political debates today, is about knowledge, is about what kind of knowledge is finally available to us in society. Paine is a great believer in government as a tool for applying technical knowledge to solve social problems. Mm-hmm. Remember, he flows from Enlightenment science. He's a big believer in a kind of science of society that can allow us to address poverty, to address inequality, to address social problems. And so he thinks it's possible at the end of the day for government to be in the business of applying technical expertise. Burke says society is much too complicated for technical solutions, fundamentally technical scientific solutions, to really work. And his idea of knowledge, one of his great innovations, is a description of social knowledge, of knowledge that's dispersed, that, as he puts it, and Friedrich Hayek likes to quote this a lot, society benefits from knowledge that no one in particular possesses, that society as a whole possesses. It's contained in the shape of its institutions, in its traditions, in the structures it's created for itself, a lot of which seem very odd and complicated and needlessly complex and
intricate. But they've evolved and they work.
But yeah, they're the way they are for a reason, Burke says. And although we may not know the reason, we know they work. And so for him, social problems can best be solved by creating circumstances in which local knowledge can be applied at the local level. If you look at the healthcare debate, which
That's
is a debate,
debate
I spent a lot of my time on,
right.
It's basically about that question.
That's the whole debate.
At the core of the debate, there's a question. And the question is, how do we balance cost and access and quality in healthcare? Liberals say, we know how. There's a science of this. There's health economics. There are these great guys at MIT who know how to do this. The problem is no one listens to us. And so the system we need is a system that will empower us to apply the right kinds of principles, to to define for everybody what, say, what the insurance product needs to be, to tell the insurers to sell it, to tell the consumers to buy it.
Right.
And we can call that a market at the end of the day if you want to. That's basically Obamacare, right? There are requirements, there are mandates, and hopefully in the middle is the kind of system that the economics suggests will work.
By the way, you also just explained why academics so heavily trend to the left, didn't you?
I think there's a lot to that.
If only people would listen to us, just
right.
think of all the problems
we have the answers.
Yes, we have the answers.
The conservative solution seems a lot more complicated than that because it basically says what we need to do is create circumstances in which people will figure this out one by one because there's no way we're going to apply one solution to a system as complicated as American healthcare and get it to work. So instead, we take the pot of money that's already there. We provide it to people, say, in increments of you know, $5,000 each. The insurers now have $1 trillion sitting there in $5,000 increments. And if they can figure out how to sell an insurance product that people will be happy with, they're going to make a lot of money. And so individually, one by one, at the state level, at the local level, at the patient level, those insurers are going to work very hard to create a system that works. And what works means is it's affordable, it's accessible, it's high quality. That's how you solve a problem like this, is not by assuming that you can know and then apply the answer, but by assuming that you can't know. And so you create a system that is always looking for the answer. I think in that sense, at the core of the healthcare debate is really something that Burke and Payne argued about very explicitly.
Right. Last couple of questions, Yuval. What American conservatives still need to learn from Edmund Burke. Near the end of the great debate, there's this passage, quote, "Today's conservatives," this is you speaking about today's conservatives, "today's conservatives are too rhetorically strident and far too open to the siren song of hyper-individualism, and they generally lack a non-radical theory of the liberal society. They could benefit by adopting Burke's focus on the social character of man, from Burke's thoroughgoing gradualism, and from his innovative liberal alternative to Enlightenment radicalism."
Yeah.
Close quote. You're going to be given the keynote at the next GOP convention?
Probably not. Look, I think that this is a...
That's a broadside against your fellow conservatives, isn't it?
No, I don't think it is. I don't think it is. The key point there from my point of view is that we lack a theory of ourselves that is adequate to us. And part of the reason for writing a book like this is to say there is a thread of our own tradition that is deeply conservative. One of the problems conservatives
have... Our own tradition. You mean American now?
Yeah, American. Okay. But the American tradition is an Anglo-American tradition,
right.
And this
I'm just trying
moment
to
has a lot to speak to.
Between us as Americans and the smaller
right.
subset of members of the modern conservative
us
movement.
Us as Americans,
okay.
Right.
All right.
And one of the things that you see in conservative thinking and conservative rhetoric is that when we reach for philosophy, we reach for radicals. We reach for Thomas Jefferson. We reach for really what is the most radical way to understand our own revolution. And we try to build on radical foundations a conservative approach to American life. That's inevitably going to be very difficult. And what happens when you do that is you end up with a very negative idea of what the purpose of politics is. That is, its goal is to avoid certain things. And so all we want to do is restrain the government from doing the wrong things. Now, it's very important to restrain the government from doing the wrong things. And that thread, that Jeffersonian thread, has a lot to tell us. But it's not the only one. There's another way of understanding what the liberal society is, which is not that it begins from these radical principles and its purpose is to achieve them, to make them real in the world, but that it arrived at these principles by becoming, over time, a great society, a society that balances equality and liberty in extraordinary ways in practice. And that what we need to do is preserve the best of that society and refine it by building on the best to address the worst. To my mind, that's a kind of definition of conservatism, to build on the best of what we are, to address the worst of what we are. And one of the things that should lead you to do is to be involved in politics and policy, to think that there is a positive role, a way to build on ourselves, a way to make America more like its best self. I think conservatives today are too quick to recoil from policy.
Too much the party of no.
Yeah, too much the party of no. We know what we're against, and we should be against it. But we need to have a much better idea of what we're for. And I think understanding Burke's kind of conservatism has a lot to teach us, both about the need to be involved in politics, so to fix small problems before they get so big that they invite really radical solutions, and about the way in which we ought to be involved in politics, which is to show our fellow citizens that we are trying to build on the best of what we have in common. Mm.
Yuval, last question. Between now and 2016, if I could make you, Edmund Burke wouldn't like this, and nor would you actually, but if I could sort of make you dictator of the conservative movement for 24 hours,
God help us.
What one lesson would you most like to impart from Edmund Burke to American conservatives today?
Yeah. I would say, again, that it is about the need to be engaged in policy arguments, that what conservatism offers is not just less of the liberal welfare state or the liberal welfare state at a cheaper price, which is roughly what we're kind of doing now. What conservatism offers is a different way to think about the place and role of government, to understand government as existing, to build that space for society to thrive. And that means that we have to be engaged in proposing policy ideas. You started out talking about reform conservatism.
Yes.
I wouldn't say I love the term, but that's what it means. It means conservatives who are offering specific, concrete policy proposals that would embody this very different way of thinking about what government is for.
So it's not enough to be the party of no, although it's useful from time to time, and it's not good enough to be the stupid party.
Well, no one wants to be the stupid party.
Although it's easy and enjoyable sometimes. All right, I've got it. Yuval, thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yuval Levin, author of The Great Debate, Edmund Burke, Thomas Paine, and the Birth of the Right and Left. Thank you. For the Hoover Institution and the Wall Street Journal, I'm Peter Robinson.